Chapter 13, Deliberation, Choice and Decision. There are usually a number of goals which we feel an urge to pursue, but it is not possible or practical to pursue all of them, certainly not all at once. Therefore, we must choose among the many possibilities the one that is most worthwhile, the one we prefer, and decide to pursue it, renouncing or postponing the others. This is where deliberation comes into play. The objective of every deliberation, of every consideration of one or more possibilities, is to lead to the best possible decision. A decision reached without deliberation, without examining and evaluating all aspects of the question or choice that confronts us, can lead to impulsive, unconsidered, and ill-advised action. This may often involve us in blunders which can damage ourselves and others. The significance of the two words unconsidered and ill-advised is worth noting. The first means to be lacking in due consideration, the second in sound counsel. The immense number of actions that are impulsively performed by human beings with no consideration of the consequences is appalling. This is because, in reality, few really think. Thinking is uncomfortable and tiring. It demands concentration, and this requires a persistent use of the will. Moreover, the outcome of such thinking may unpleasantly conflict with some of our inclinations and drives. Hence, the fundamental importance, indeed the necessity, of learning to think properly, to reflect and meditate. See Appendix 2, page 218. The techniques of the control and the most effective utilization of one's own mind are among the most valuable in psychosynthesis. They constitute a basic preparation for deliberation, for the work of consideration and reflection that must precede a sound decision. But to have the space needed to think, meditate, and then decide, we must keep in abeyance the tendencies and drives that impel us towards immediate action. This means taking time, the time needed to examine the situation from all angles and reflect upon it. Thus, the prerequisite of thinking and deliberation is an act of restraint, of inhibition. Inhibiting function of the will. Professor Kahlo has correctly pointed out an apparently paradoxical aspect of the will. The volitional act is, from one very important point of view, substantially inhibition. It is not, however, an automatic inhibition, like that which a tendency or the energy inherent in an idea can exercise against another tendency or idea. But it is willed, first against all of them, in order that deliberation itself may be possible, then in the decision against those drives which are still in competition with the chosen aim. This aspect of inhibition can be more or less striking. In some cases, the entire effort of willing appears to consist only, but never does so consist, in the effort of inhibiting certain tendencies, and to be reduced to a non-willing. While in other cases, the decision is made so rapidly and easily that it seems to be done without the intervention of the will. To modern ears, the word inhibition carries a rather unpleasant sound. It brings to mind repression and its unfortunate consequences. It can be said that today there is a veritable phobia regarding repression. Therefore, it is worthwhile clarifying the great difference that exists between repression and conscious control. To repress an impulse is to condemn it, to try to obliterate it or bottle it up in the unconscious and pretend that it doesn't exist. But whatever is repressed returns later, and often in disguise, to claim its due. Inhibition, on the other hand, consists in resolutely holding back an impulse or tendency while deliberating on how best to deal with it. Therefore, repression is not in order, but rightly used, inhibition can be the mark of wisdom. We may inhibit the expression of a stupid or harmful impulse without repressing it. We recognize the impulse, examine and analyze it, and then direct or transmute it, or even act it out, at a more appropriate time. If we repress, we become victims of what we deny. But if we use inhibition wisely, we gain freedom and mastery. In regard to what Professor Kahlo says, it should be pointed out that inhibition per se is not a stage of will. It is a quality that is needed not only in preparing for volitional action, but also a necessary condition in all stages of will. Deliberation. It has already been stated in the preceding chapter that one of the chief requirements for a truly volitional act is the bringing to light and examination of unconscious motives. When this is done, we can then see to it that our conscious motives are good and that they imply acts that are constructive both for ourselves and for others. But this is not sufficient. It is well to be explicit on this point because many believe that good intentions are enough. The well-known saying, "The road to hell is paved with good intentions," can be taken in two senses. The first and more obvious one refers to the inertia and weakness of so many good people. Their intentions are not followed by decisions, affirmations, and acts, and so they remain ineffective. The other meaning refers to the bad consequences that can follow acts that are committed with the best of intentions, but with little wisdom. These acts are indeed sometimes completely lacking in common sense. Examples of this kind of mistaken action are decisions taken by some parents and imposed on their children in the sincere belief that they are for the children's good. Such parents may push them, for instance, against their wishes in the direction of some remunerative or prestigious career, or perhaps they protect them excessively and thereby prevent them from gaining the necessary experience on their own, even if it involves some hardship and a reasonable amount of risk. So the first few steps in the process of deliberation consist in seeing clearly, in posing the problem plainly, in formulating the alternatives with which we are faced, and in considering the path that the outcome that will follow each alternative. This approach applies to deliberating about different goals or about a single goal. In the latter case, the alternatives can pertain to different possibilities for realizing that goal, or simply to whether to pursue it or not. This clear posing of alternatives seems obvious, but very often it is not done. The next comes the recognition, from a realistic standpoint, of the possibility of achieving one's purpose or purposes, and of the appropriate time for action. At this stage, one establishes a natural sequence for the various steps and for their timing in passing from the initial project through the program to the actualization of one's goal. It has been said that politics is the art of the possible, but it could be added that a large part of wisdom, at least of practical wisdom, consists in ascertaining what is possible and when it is so. It is here that so many idealists err, nobly but with unfortunate results. They keep their eyes so fixed on the sparkling mountaintop that they do not watch where they are putting their feet and risk stumbling and falling, or they attempt to climb up steep slopes of a mountain by a direct but impractical route instead of following a winding but manageable path. It is necessary to consider the consequences of the action that we propose to take. This is an exercise in foresight. It demands careful reflection and psychological discrimination, particularly when the involvement and cooperation of others is concerned. If we fail to do this, our words and acts may well produce effects very different from those we expect and desire. One of the simplest examples is to be seen when our insistence and eagerness arouse negative reactions in others. In these cases, merely mental considerations do not suffice. What is needed is empathy, that is, the capacity to enter, so to speak, into the skin of others, and by means of intuitive imagination, become aware of the effect of our words, the effect our words and acts may produce. Inspiration and intuition. Let us now examine another way of making decisions, especially those that are determined by motives originating in or arriving via the higher unconscious, superconscious, in the form of illuminations, inspirations, and urges to actions, both inner and outer. Broadly speaking, such motives can be considered transpersonal in character. Artistic creativity, altruistic and humanitarian impulses, the search for truth, etc. Their origin often cannot be identified with certainty. They may be activities of the superconscious. They may come from the higher or transpersonal self, or they may have other sources. But it is not necessary to ascertain where they originate. What is important is to recognize these incentives, these inspirations, to open oneself to them and to welcome them. I have said welcome them because we are not always willing to do so. Sometimes they bewilder us and even arouse negative reactions, either on the part of the conscious self or from elements of the lower unconscious. In fact, these inspirations and urges often make the individual uncomfortable because they goad him into assuming undertakings and take actions that call for a spirit of self-sacrifice, surrender, or risk. On the other hand, these inspirations and inner urges are not to be accepted and followed without being subject to careful scrutiny. First of all, it is necessary to determine whether they are genuine intuitions or inspirations. In other words, do these promptings to act really come from the exalted level of the superconscious? We must distinguish them from those impulses that come from other levels of the unconscious or from external influences. The difference is sometimes evident, but often it is not, and its recognition can be very difficult. We live immersed in a psychic ocean, enveloped in a psychic atmosphere. We are continually subject to the influences of every kind and source. Therefore, a cautious attitude of continuous discrimination is necessary, particularly in the case of individuals with great psychic sensitivity. Furthermore, even when an inspiration emanates from a truly elevated source and the intuition is genuine, serious errors can be made in its interpretation and consequently in its execution. Such errors often do occur. Adequate mental development is needed to understand these inspirations and promptings correctly. Also, firm self-control is needed to avoid excessive emotional reactions, sometimes mounting to exaltation, and/or impulsive and fanatical behaviour. Thus, what has been said about other motives is also applicable in this case. Do not let yourself be drawn immediately into action, but by an act of will, exercise the inhibition that will give time for thorough examination of the inspiration and for determining whether it is genuine and its adoption advisable. However, although careful discrimination must be used, we should also be wary of an excessively critical attitude that might stifle inspiration. Some people have a tendency to question excessively, producing doubts and confusion, although experience has shown that in many cases, their original intuitive flash, the first incentive, was right. So here again, balance, or in other words, the use of wisdom, is needed. These difficulties should not deter us either from using the approach of arriving at correct choices, or from following our higher promptings. On the contrary, those who do not have spontaneous inspirations or intuitions can make use of the available methods for activating the superconscious and for linking it with the conscious personality. The most reliable ones are the various procedures of receptive and reflective meditation. These, as well as other techniques, are described in Appendix 2, see page 218. In all cases of deliberation, the aim is to use well-tested practices to enlist the highest mental powers in the process of deliberation and choice. These can range from truly concentrated thinking to opening oneself to inspiration while in a state of inner silence. The reader will want to experiment with these and other meditative techniques, such as those mentioned in psychosynthesis. But one which has direct application to the stage of deliberation is that of consulting the higher self. Naturally, it takes some practice, and it can be gradually refined, but it consists essentially in asking, whether aloud, silently, or in writing, the advice of the higher self on a particular matter. It is surprising to find how often the answer to a difficult problem comes, sooner or later, from a source that is within us, from the highest part of ourselves. Consulting with others. This is another method of arriving at decisions. One that is incidentally useful for checking the validity of any inner promptings. It can be of great help, but like any other single technique, it is often the source of drawbacks and errors. Its success depends as much on the attitude adopted and the method used by the seeker of advice as on those of the giver. However, many situations can greatly benefit from its use, particularly when the decisions involve others. It is most advisable, of course, when we are not certain of our ability to judge correctly, either for want of information or because we lack competence in the particular subject matter. The many advantages of this method are not always recognised. In the first place, the very process of telling our problem to another person helps us to formulate it clearly, to objectify it, so to speak, and thus to understand it better. Sometimes, simply the act of stating a problem in clear terms brings out the solution and lets us see the way to go, even before the other person responds. Apart from this, the questions of the person we are consulting, his way of considering the matter, often put a different light on things and make us aware of other possible points of view. Moreover, our verbal expression can serve to discharge the emotions aroused by the situation and thus to reduce or eliminate this great source of confusion and mistakes. The act of precise formulation also helps us to curb the often restless overactivity of the mind and compels it to think in an orderly way. Finally, there is also the subtle and indefinable but genuine effect of the mere presence of a willing and understanding listener. This can be said to be catalytic because it is analogous to the role performed in chemical reaction by a substance that does not itself form part of the compound but whose presence makes possible or accelerates the reaction. This chemical action has not yet been fully explained, but it is very effective. Here again, just as we do not have to understand the exact nature of catalysts in order to make use of it, we can take advantage of the very substantial effect of a sympathetic listener to help us make decisions without being able to clearly define the process. The difficulties in consulting others arise when the motive of the inquirer is to evade his own responsibilities and indulge in the tendency present in many people to lean on others, to give them indiscriminate credence, and to be blinded or at least strongly influenced by their prestige or by their presumed authority. Much recent worship of therapists, political leaders, gurus, and others stems from this tendency to escape from responsibility and freedom. This can be considered as a manifestation of the general tendency to rely on external authorities, something which has happened over and over again against the will of genuine teachers and sages. One thinks of the latter followers of Pythagoras who used as a final answer, ipsi dixit, he said it. Another instance is of the authority accorded to Aristotle, which had a hampering influence on thought throughout the Middle Ages and aroused in the Renaissance bitter attacks against those who dared to question it. Another disadvantage can occur when we turn to a number of people for advice. Their frequently contrasting opinions may increase our uncertainty. In addition, a person seeking advice lays himself open to a further pitfall. He may indeed be the recipient of well-defined and pertinent advice, but this deprives him of the opportunity of arriving at a decision by himself, gaining useful experience and therefore developing this part of the will, this aspect of the will. Excessive interference on the part of those whose advice has not been asked may account for the reaction expressed in the well-known reply, "Don't tell me what to do, I can make my own mistakes." Counselling. Nevertheless, there is a correct counselling technique which is worth learning. A careful choice of the terms to be used is of value in determining the attitude to be taken and the mode of procedure to be adopted by both parties. Instead of talking in terms of asking advice, it is better to say consulting. The person to whom we address ourselves, instead of pontificating as an advisor, assumes the role of consultant, who provides information and an opinion. There are several ways in which a consultant can help. One, by assisting one to formulate clearly the problem to be deliberated upon, the questions to be solved, by assembling and working out all the relevant and useful data and information, and then by coordinating them in such a way as to pose the matter in its clearest possible terms. Two, when the problem concerns relations with other individuals, for instance, one's children, spouse, parents, employer, or subordinates, by helping one to see that due consideration is given to their points of view. Even intelligent and sensitive people may suffer from specific blind spots that allow them to make unfair and excessive demands on others. They are honestly surprised when their expectations provoke hostile and even violent reactions. 3. By directing attention to the inevitable consequences of the various possible choices, and by illustrating how certainly the law of cause and effect is likely to respond to one's actions. A consultant can present not only the consequences of a particular outer action, but also the equally real consequences of a particular inner psychological action. We easily forget that psychological decisions have definite psychological effects. 4. By assisting the inquirer in finding the correct interpretations of the impressions and indications that he has received from unconscious and especially superconscious urges and intuitions. The method of consultation can be employed very simply in the form of dialogue. The dialogue method is not new. The most famous exemplar of it was Socrates, as recorded by Plato. One is struck by Socrates' skillful and shrewd procedure and by the subtle art with which he leads his interlocutor to the personal discovery of the truth and to the adoption of a clear way of thinking. The method of the dialogue has recently been accorded renewed validation, particularly by Martin Buber and Ira Prokof, and is finding increasing application in psychotherapy. Various forms of dialogue have been given serious consideration by Paul Tournier and his associates in the movement called Medicine of the Personality. A meeting of this group in Zurich in 1967 was devoted to various aspects of the dialogue for the general practitioner, the marital dialogue, parapsychology and dialogue, the dialogue for the psychiatrist, the dialogue with God, the dialogue in meditation. Meditating with others is also very helpful, and the experienced individual can teach its technique and direct a group effectively. Moreover, to stay silent together promotes a catalytic action and facilitates the descent of intuitions and inspirations. Collective deliberation. This method of deliberating has always been in use, for good or ill. The modern world is employing it increasingly, assisted by the rapidity of communication. It has specific advantages, but is not devoid of shortcomings. Its most obvious advantage is the opportunity that it provides for revealing and defining the different facets of the problem situation that is to be resolved. By allowing it to be considered from the various points of view contributed by diverse skills of each member of the group. But this procedure pulls and balances each one's qualities. There is an enhanced probability that unanimous or majority decisions thus arrived at will turn out to be both fair and appropriate. This is the democratic method in the best sense of the word. But good results depend on whether all who share in the deliberation adopt an objective and dispassionate approach and are animated by a sincere intention to arrive at the best possible solution. It would be naive to expect this to happen always. In many cases, preconceptions, individual and group prejudices, and not least the obstinacy and pique aroused by pride, will induce some participants to attempt to impose their personal opinions without truly listening to the ideas of others. Moreover, not infrequently, the pros and cons which have emerged from the various aspects of the discussion seem to balance each other out and block a clear-cut decision. This begets uncertainties and leads to the decision to postpone the decision. Examples of this are plentiful, and the greater the number of consultants, the more likely it is to happen. As the humorist P. Lafitte remarked, one administrator administers, 3 administrators study the best way of administrating, 5 administrators discuss conflicting programs, 7 administrators chatter. And yet, in spite of the serious defects of this consultative method, the dictatorial or authoritarian system, with its power of decision residing in the hands of a single individual, is more perilous and opens the door to real disaster. Camille Cavour, the Italian Prime Minister of the Kingdom of Piedmont, had this to say, "I prefer the worst Chamber of Deputies to the best royal antechamber." Moreover, in many cases, collective deliberation and decision are unavoidable. Let us see then how it can be regulated so as both to limit its defects and to utilise what advantages it offers. The first rule is to reduce to a minimum the number of those who are to have a hand in the decisions. This does not exclude the participation of experts in the examination of the question, but it limits them to a consultative role. Another rule is to put time limits on both discussion and decision. A third and important rule demands that those who make decisions assume all responsibility for them as a group, no less than as individuals. In addition to these general rules for the method of collective deliberation, there are others to be applied according to the different situations that call for decision. I cannot deal with them here, except to advocate that the decisions each of us finds himself having to make with others be conducted as much as possible on the basis of equality. The proper attitude to take can be summed up in this simple practical formula: let us not argue but look for the best solution together. This demands of each the preparation already recommended for individual deliberation, that is to say, the examination of personality, motives and reasons. Individuality differences. At this point, it seems appropriate to discuss the factor of characterological differences. So far, the subject of deliberation and decision has been dealt with in a general way. But here too, as in every psychological issue, there are often marked personal differences that should be taken into full account. Methods should be adapted to each psychological type. Applying this to the subject under examination, we must first of all distinguish 2 opposite human types, the impulsive and the indecisive. What I have said so far applies in particular to the impulsives. Impulsive people need to practice often all the techniques of calm deliberation, inhibition, and meditation. Indecisives, who represent a minority, call for a different approach. They must be faced with the necessity for making decisions. They must learn to do so by seizing opportunities on the fly at the right moment. There is an Oriental maxim that has significance for both types. One cannot mount a camel that has not yet arrived, or one that has already departed. We can distinguish 2 different causes, or groups of causes, of indecision. One which may be considered constitutional occurs in introverted types who indulge in excessive and sterile self-analysis. They often have a sense of inferiority. Here, an important distinction should be made between a feeling of inferiority or superiority and an inferiority or superiority complex. This word complex is used in a rather loose fashion, whereas it should be reserved for serious, even pathological cases. Everyone has a sense of superiority or inferiority. This represents no complex, but is simply an inner attitude that is usually well within the bounds of normality. We are all superior in some things and inferior in others, but the introvert's general feeling of inferiority, or even his inferiority complex, is usually not justified because he is frequently intelligent and gifted with aesthetic and moral sensitivity. Other causes of indecision are conflicts between unconscious and conscious motives, fear of making a mistake and unwillingness to assume responsibility. The last is sometimes due to regrets for mistakes committed in the past. Psychotherapeutic assistance or self-psychotherapy can help reveal these causes and to eliminate them. Indecisives must clearly recognise that to decide is inevitable. As has already been mentioned, not to decide is in itself a decision and may well be the worst one. They have to develop the courage to make mistakes. They must recognise that errors are rarely irredeemable and often prove productive as sources of experience. Science and technology continually employ the trial and error method. Indecisives are sometimes reduced to the state of dithering uncertainly by small choices of no importance. At such times, a toss-up decision is in order. Two other psychological types should be kept distinct from the just mentioned. They are the obstinate and the changeable. An indecisive, once he has laboriously arrived at his decision, may cling to it tenaciously, while an impulsive can be easily swayed, uncritically and without self-control, by alternating impulses to act. On the other hand, obstinacy can be the effect of pride or of a mental rigidity which restricts the field of view to only one aspect of a many-sided and changing reality. These people can be helped to see clearly the difference between obstinacy and will, which can be confused at a superficial level of observation. Many believe and maintain that they have a strong will when they are merely stubborn. As for changeableness, it can originate in a too open and plastic mind, which sees some validity in every alternative and recognizes the continual renewal of life in constantly changing forms. Changeable people need to realize that there are unchanging laws governing the evolution of life and that our decisions can be taken up and upheld in harmony with them. All psychological types can undertake the adjustment of their character excesses and limitations by bringing the will into play in different and sometimes opposite ways, but always with a clear vision, decision, and wisdom. The acts of deliberation and decision require mental alertness, adequate preparation, vigilance, and self-control. In short, a resolute and continual application of the will. Choice. A fundamental fact of which we should be clearly aware is that to decide very often means to choose. That is, a selection must be made from among various possibilities. But to choose implies to prefer, and to prefer some one thing, one action, one way, necessarily demands the discarding or eliminating of others, i.e. their relinquishment. This is obvious, or should be, and thus easily accepted, yet in practice it arouses strong resistance and reluctance, often indeed violent rebellion. The very words renunciation and sacrifice excite intense aversion. And we've got a footnote here. It is interesting and illuminating to realize that rather than meaning a painful self-inflicted asceticism, the word sacrifice means to make holy, to make sacred, sacrum facere. Various causes are at the root of these reactions. 1. Hedonism, i.e. the fundamental desire for pleasure and for the avoidance of suffering, which is innate in human nature. 2. The exaggerated emphasis placed in the past on duty and sacrifice, and the excessive insistence on the value of suffering, often for wrong or needless reasons. 3. An erroneous conception of liberty, which has been interpreted as the right to follow every impulse and satisfy every desire without concern for consequences to ourselves or others, with a complete lack of restraint or sense of responsibility. From all this springs more or less conscious refusal to choose, when a choice is clearly needed. It represents an attempt to have one's cake and eat it too. Thus leads to frustration, double blinds, inner conflict, loss of opportunity, and exactly that unnecessary suffering which was the original desire to avoid. As was previously pointed out, an important criterion in choosing is to foresee in the clearest possible manner what effects the choice will have, not only the immediate but also the long-term ones, since the latter can turn out to be different from, and indeed opposite to, the former. Sometimes that is immediately satisfactory. Sometimes that is immediately satisfactory can have harmful effects later. The ability to select from alternatives and the wisdom to choose well can, like all other functions, be developed by the means of methodical training incorporating appropriate exercises. This training can best be begun with the making of decisions and choices about matters of little or no importance in themselves. By eliminating for the moment every element of personal interest or selfish gratification, the pure inner act by which a decision is made can be isolated. It may be exercised through the choice of taking one street in preference to another, or similarly, when in a restaurant, by choosing one dish instead of the others. Everyone can make up numerous exercises of the sort. These can then be followed by choices between alternatives of growing importance, keeping always in mind that a choice is a preference which therefore implies the elimination and giving up of alternatives. It is important to also realize that, if one wants to accomplish an aim to which a value is attributed, one must also will the means of pursuing it, however unpleasant and painful they may be. A simple and effective help in achieving this is to call often to mind and repeat the affirmation, "It is worth the effort." Thus, the choice and its associated renunciations can be made with good grace, even cheerfully. In the matter of making choices, it is essential to recognize that there are usually a few basic chores that enter into the many specific choices. A specific fundamental one is the choice between the past and the future. We are in a period of drastic change and rapid renewal. Many old forms do not work anymore. The old ways of life prove increasingly inadequate to meet present needs. Therefore, it is vain to remain attached to them and to delude ourselves by thinking that we can preserve them intact. On the other hand, the new is not to be chosen in a hurry and without discernment. At present, we are witnessing violent, excessive, and ill-considered attempts to change everything at once. The renewal can and should be regulated by appropriate choices, wise decisions, and a firm will. We should not abandon established ways without having found new and better ones. But once we have found new ways, we must have the courage and the will to throw ourselves boldly and joyfully into the adventure which the future holds. End of chapter 13.